Welcome to Think Big with Dan and Kasim. Join host Dan Melnick and Kasim Masood as they explore big ideas, limitless possibilities, and engage with visionaries, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders who dare to dream big. Get inspired, motivated, and find practical tips for personal growth. Think big, dream bigger, and ignite your potential.
All right, welcome to Think Big with Dan and Kasim, and we have Mateen filling in for Kasim today, and our guest is Greg. So, Greg, if you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, tell us where you live and what you do for a living.
So, my name is Greg Boland. I am a venture capitalist by training. I'm one of the managing partners for Union Grove Venture Partners. We've had a very lucky run. We were named number one by the Wall Street Journal for private equity fund of funds, their last roundup. So we are 100% focused on venture investing. Then my weekend job, I'm a farmer who has spent over the last 10 years time building a new kind of grape. And we just 2 weeks ago were certified as the first regenerative vineyard in the United States. So we're excited.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So how did you get started in your career, you know, being an inventor and also now more recently, you know, owning a farm? Like, what was that like for you, you know, early on and how you got the start?
I was an investment banker. I came out of high school or college and I was a farmer. And then I ended up buying a bank, selling a bank, and going to work at Merrill Lynch as a stockbroker and worked my way into covering venture capital relationships at Merrill, and then extended that in J.C. Bradford, Payne Weber, and UBS. I spent a lot of time in the venture community trying to generate revenue from those guys, and eventually got invited to be a part of the families in a lot of those great firms as an investor, and spent time then working on doing deals, doing transactions for those firms, and then investing in them as a part of Wasatch Advisors, which was a fund based in Salt Lake City.
So what was your biggest challenge early on when you started, you know, when you got started in the venture space?
Not knowing what I didn't know. There is a lot of subtlety. Venture capital in the core business is there are two things. It's a relationship business and it's a story business. And it's important to be able to tell stories. And I don't mean tell, you know, fantasy stories. I mean, be able to tell stories about opportunities that you've seen or why you'd be a good investor in a fund or in a firm, to be able to convince people to let you in and to open the doors. Because it's hard to get in, still hard to get in the best funds, and it's still hard to get in the very best deals. So I always told people it's a double-sided business where you spend all your time on your knees. You're begging for access or you're begging for opportunity.
So how do you find these right opportunities? I mean, you've obviously been very successful. I mean, you invest, like, for example, like, I'm from Chicago. I know Spot Hero, like, it's a great company. I've used their app, you know? So it's like, how do you find these opportunities where, you know, you're investing, okay, this is going to be a good fit for us?
So yeah, Spot Hero is a great company. And you're going to start hearing a lot more about them over the next couple of years. They are doing extraordinarily well. They went through I'll answer your question in a minute, but I'm a big Spot Hero advocate. They went through a time period where their revenue went to zero. So they went from 40 million to zero in COVID and had to decide what they wanted to do. And so I think the CEO was very wise in convincing the board to spend money on technology during that time period. And they emerged with a much higher market share on the backside of COVID than they had before. And I think an opportunity to win ever more business in space. And they've just done a fantastic job. And that's what, you know, you invest in management teams. You don't invest in ideas because the ideas can be a pivot. And there was certainly a pivot place in Spot Hero's story. But the way that I find opportunities is through good friends. People tell me about companies that they think are good companies, and they make an introduction for me, and I get a chance to spend time with the company and, you know, ultimately make an invest or no invest decision. And we look at probably 50 companies for every one that we invest in, and those are all been curated by the funds that I invest in already. So it's a, you know, there's a lot of good subset of companies that we look at to write a check into. And we have to make a decision a lot of times because we don't take a lot of capital. We only take $200 million at a time. 80% of that dollar amount goes into funds and 30% goes into direct deals. And so I know that math doesn't add up, but you can overinvest in funds because, you know, not all the money is called immediately. Money is called over time and you have some return of capital in the funds in the interim cycle. And so, you end up with a very scarce set of capital. You have to pick very wisely and very carefully. And every investment that we make is a fight, you know, in the partnership to try and get it approved because it's very limited in size. And we do something different than all the other fund-to-funds. We do all of our own work on our own deals. And we don't have a staff of people to do the work. We do the work ourselves. And the end result is that you build great relationships with quick no's or solid yeses. And so we try and practice that. We look at things very quickly and say, no, that's not going to be a fit for us. Or yes, we're interested. We need to do more work. And then we do the work. And that's how you get invited back again and again to, you know, to take a look at deals is because you've been a good citizen.
So when you're having these early conversations, like how much of the conversation is you trying to convince them to use your firm versus them trying to, you know, convince you to invest in them? Like, I'm sure there's probably both of these things, like, you know, that you're trying to sell yourself, they're trying to sell themselves. So like, what do these conversations look like?
But is for a fund or for a company?
Well, just for a company. Answers. Yeah, I guess company. for a company. Yeah.
So for a company, we try and be really smart when we meet with the management team and ask questions that we think are important and relative. And CEO knows when somebody knows the space or somebody knows the right questions to ask. And if you don't, you're not going to be value add. You're just going to be, you know, what we call mullet money. You know, you cast out a net and you just drag in whatever you get. And that's mullet money. On the other hand, we try and be very targeted with our decisions and have real conversations with CEOs or management teams. And they pretty much know, I mean, look, a lot of times our reputation precedes us. We've had a lot of good exits. We've had really strong returns. I think our return is 28% net IRR across all of our funds. And for a fund of funds, that puts us in the first quartile for venture capital, let alone fund of funds. So we have a lot of diversity in the investment base that reduces a lot of the beta risk, but still gives us a lot of alpha in the portfolio. So anyway, a lot of times it's preceded by who we are, and they know by reputation that we have a pretty good reputation. But still, on some deals, it's, you know, there's a lot of convincing. You know, we can be helpful, and here's why we can be helpful. And you know, I think certainly you can argue that Beyond Meat was not a successful public company. It was a very successful offering. That's something we have a lot of experience with because of my investment banking background, is trying to help companies figure out the best way to present themselves to the public markets. That's a good skill to have around the table when the time is right. So that's how we get on cap table.
So, Ren, how has technology played a role in your career so far?
Well, technology is how I got into the business to begin with. I was in college. I answered an ad on the bulletin board at the computers called CERO, Computer Engineering Research Laboratory, for coders. And I had coded as a ham radio operator. We had coded back in COBOL, which was the predecessor to C. And so we worked on writing. We were part of the DARPA project with the University of in UC Berkeley, where we wrote the code for packaging technology. So, you know, I was a ham radio operator, and then I got a chance to do a little bit of that stuff. And I've been a big lover of technology for a long time. I've had a long love affair. In fact, if you look in my office here on the wall, I've got a magazine from Electronics Magazine, the 1964 edition, where Moore's Law was first published. And so, I've been a big believer in Gordon Moore's postulate, and he's been right. You know, everybody says we're out of time, we're not going to do it anymore. But we've managed to continuously advance. The advancements have led to where we're at now, which is a lot of waves crashing on shore at the same time. that have been led by technology. So you have all this computing power that we've not previously had that you're able to apply to a lot of different industries. AI, machine learning, all of that is the end result of Moore's Law being applied down through the stack.
What would you say, speaking of those things, AI and machine learning, what is the role of those two things in the companies that you're investing in right now?
Well, a great example is a company called Tortuga. Tortuga is a robotics company based in Colorado that harvests strawberries and grapes. And they use machine learning and AI to help the machine pick the best grapes and the best path towards retrieving the grapes, putting them into the cases for resale. So if it's that far and it's that wide, it's being used everywhere for, it's almost like everywhere, everything all at once, right? That company's been using it for 4 years, so it's not like it's brand new and, just happened in the last year, but markets become aware of a lot of it in the last year, the role that it can play and why it can be increasingly valuable to returns for investors.
So do you think that in the next couple of years, we're going to see all these call centers or folks that are, answering like live chats going away with all this technology?
Probably going to be significantly reduced, right, Dan?
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't have to see around. So in our industry, we always talk about seeing around corners. That's the ultimate compliment that you can give somebody. And, I don't think you have to be very perceptive to look around that corner to realize that a lot of information requests are going to be continued to be handled by machines.
So in terms of your business right now, so you mentioned that you're running a grape farm, right? So what did that process look like for you? It's like, because you've been obviously in VC for a long time and now you're started this farm. So I guess, first of all, what made you want to do it? And second, like, how are you able to manage your time doing, investing and running this farm as well?
Yeah, great people. That's the answer on how I manage my time. I have staff to be a regenerative, to be labeled the first regenerative grape farm in the United States that quickly is an accomplishment. And it relates back to all the people and all the work that they've been doing and building the soils and trying to make the farm ultimately highly successful and unusually profitable. And so we spent 9 years developing a new kind of grape that would grow in this soil, in this temperate climate. And we found one with the help of Jeff Bloodworth, who was a breeder from NC State. And then left NC State, took his life's work with him, and he was able to breed a thin-skinned, seedless muscadine. So if you think about a Thompson grape and the bite feel that a Thompson grape has, and you combine it with the flavor of a muscadine, which if you've ever had a muscadine before, we call it a juice bomb wrapped in shoe leather. It's an intense burst of flavor that's highly nutritious. But then you got to spit out the seed and the skin, and it's just, yeah. It's awful, but you get that intense burst with our grape, and at the same time, you don't have that, that latent awful punch of the seeds and it's an unpleasant experience to eat a muscadine, but because they're so good, people eat.
In terms of your farm, what would you say, are your top priorities in the next 3 to 6 months?
Well, we're planning at a rapid pace. So we're planning between 60 and 100 acres a year, and that's bigger than most vineyards. Total size. And the only way we can do that is through technology. Mohammed, I guess you could say I'm really a technology fan because we couldn't do what we're doing without the use of extreme technology. That's the biggest challenge is to plant that much acreage at one time and make the plants thrive and be successful. And building a vineyard of that scale, there are a lot of things involved. And getting lines straight, we have to build the soil first. So we put in about 6 inches of topsoil in a band 30 inches wide that we build. And we have our own vermiculture lab here where we build all of our own soil. So we have to put that down. That has to get incorporated in the soil. Then we have to to subsoil, to break up clay pans in this hard, you know, hard clay soil, to make sure we have drainage. It's just, everything's a challenge. There isn't anything easy about what we're doing, which is why nobody has done it before at the scale and the rapid pace that we're doing.
So is the goal to be a direct-to-consumer brand, or are you more focused on B2B?
No, we're a direct-to-consumer brand. We will be a direct-to-consumer brand. That's important because we believe in food as medicine, and this grape has the highest polyphenolic content of any fruit that's available in the market today. So we believe grown without chemicals, without herbicides, without pesticides, on top of the intensive grooming that we've done. We went through 9,000 plants to get one plant. We spent a lot of time trying to make sure we had the right things. And so we were able to get a premium in the marketplace. So that's what we've done. We focused on building a really good for you food that happens to be incredibly good. And we just pulled our first grapes off the vine today. And so people are standing around amazed at the intense flavor and the quality.
Amazing. So what is the one biggest piece of advice that you wished you knew before you started your career?
Don't be afraid to fail, but learn from every time you fail. So make sure that if you fail, it's a worthwhile exercise and not just a failure.
That's good advice. So if we're going to have this conversation again in 1 year from now, where do you expect things to go for your farm?
We'll, a year from now, we'll have 78,000 plants in the world, and we should be training on the wires with our first year plantings, and we should have enough grapes in the market to have a real test of whether my hypothesis was right or not.
That's awesome. So if somebody watching this wanted to reach out to you or to find your farm, do you mind sharing the best way to get in contact with you and your farm website?
Yeah, it's the most complicated email address, farm address you'll ever find. So it's ug.farm, uniongrove.farm. And my email address is g@ug.farm. So it's almost the shortest email address you can have on the internet. And a lot of websites won't accept it as an email address because it's so short.
That's awesome. Well, Greg, thank you so much for your time. Hopefully we can chat again in a year from now as your farm continues to grow and gets more business.
Great. Thanks, guys. Take care.
Thanks. All right. Bye.
Bye.